This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the draft. How does it work today, and should it be changed? Tonight's guest, Selective Service Director, Lieutenant General Louis B. Hersey. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-3357, and from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Our Night Call topic for tonight is one of great controversy and agonizing decisions. We are talking about the draft, with the man who is in a position to make life and death decisions about thousands of American men. He is Lieutenant General Louis B. Hersey, the Director of Selective Service. Never before in our nation's history have so many young people said, "No, no, I won't go." Never before have so many prominent people, young and old, worked against the draft. Just what is the problem, and what can we do about it? Should our system be on a voluntary basis? Should we, or should we not, recognize the man who insists that he is a conscientious objector? Can our military system survive that kind of individualism? Or is universal and compulsory service essential to our national security? These are some of the questions General Hersey has been hearing for 28 years. But now, to some extent, the questions are being asked by more and more people. General Hersey, good evening, sir.
Good evening, mister. How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
General Hersey, on what basis do you feel we should select our men to go into military services?
Well, personally, I happen to be in favor of universal military training, but I don't think there's any chance of getting Congress to pass it when our needs as small as we are now. With the needs as large as they are, however, I do not believe you can run a volunteer system. Therefore, I think you're forced into some sort of a selective system.
Well, when you say universal training, how would the universal training differ from our draft system?
We take everyone who was physically fit and would probably extend the physical fitness as far as we could. Now, we're probably taking less than a third of the people who were born 19, 20 years ago.
Well, now, when you mention the selective service, you're saying that where there is a need for a large number of men, selective service as we know it today kind of fits the bill.
Well, if your numbers are reasonably large, 3.5 million with our population is small, but it's too big, I believe, to get by volunteer recruiting, so I think you're forced into some system where you don't take everybody, but you take some of them by compulsion.
And universal training would be limited to what, about 1.5 million men?
Well, universal military training would get you probably around 1.5 million, and there isn't that need in the armed force. I don't believe the Congress will ever permit training when someone doesn't know exactly what they're training for. That is, when they're training for an indefinite future. I don't believe they'll give you a right to draw compulsory.
General, just where does the right of the individual end and the need and security of the nation take over?
That's pretty good. When back on the farm, we used to say that you could swing your fist, you had a perfect right to it, but if you got somebody out near somebody else's nose, then your individual right ended. And I think in any cooperative society, you've got to so conduct yourself so that everybody can have their liberty, because liberty's got to be shared rather than monopolized.
How do we compare in numbers the number of volunteer enlistees in the armed services as opposed to the draftees?
Oh, it'll run normally somewhere around 3 to 1, 3 or 2 to 1, something like that. We induct somewhere around 250,000 to 300,000 a year and probably enlist twice that many.
Does the draft discriminate rich against poor or black against white?
Yes, both ways. First place, a great many people are poor that have not had educational opportunities, escaped the draft, and therefore you can say that that's unfair. And of course, anyone goes to college, for example, during the time he's going to college, he may be escaping the draft, but about 95% of our officers down in Vietnam are college trained, so therefore the armed forces gained a trained leader rather than an untrained person by letting him finish college where they took him.
What about black against white?
Well, black against white, there's where, unfortunately, and I think it's very unfortunate, educational opportunities is denied a great many of the blacks from being acceptable. Our rejection rate down the states where there's lots of blacks is much, much higher than it is otherwise. And, of course, you don't have to go into the armed forces to find the problems of a society trying to adjust itself to some new conditions.
General Hershey, we have heard much and we have read a great deal about the draft resistance. How many draft resistors do you have on record, and how many of these
were? Well, that's very hard to say. The numbers are far less than most anybody that reads the papers, watches the television, or even listens to the radio would think. Our percentages are very small compared with the total, but on the other hand, anybody that has to do with them, any numbers is too great numbers, and therefore, when you get into a few thousand that are really actively trying to uproot things, you got far too many, even though they wouldn't be any considerable part of 1%.
Well, in the area of the attempt to resist the draft, we also think in terms of the individual who doesn't believe that in the draft and who believes that being drafted goes against his conscience. Should we recognize the right of the individual if he doesn't
believe
the draft?
Well, what we are doing is recognizing the right of conscience if it has a religious basis. And that has been rather historical with us for a very long time. We recognized it different ways, but even back in colonial days, we did give some attention to conscience, but the Congress has never been convinced that you dare trust something as loose as each individual's decision as whether you want to participate. I think the Congress in general would say that the things that a man owes to some higher being, they'll recognize, but the things that are between men, they legislate on, and therefore for philosophical or economic or social reasons, you can't have your conscience as a protection. That's about what the law says, and I think I would, as far as it goes, support it, because when you get away from religion, you get into such a wide area that I don't see how you could do anything except let everybody escape service if you didn't want to do it.
Well, there are certain religious denominations or members of certain religious denominations whose draft resistance is recognized, such as the Mennonites.
Well,
and
it is. I think I'd like to use the word whose cooperation is recognized rather than resistance, because they do participate in work of national importance and in probably not maybe in dangers, although I've lost some individuals who are doing alternate work by being killed in the battle areas, so they were engaged in work, though, of civilian work. So there's quite a little hardship involved in alternate service, and that's one of the ways you find out how sincere a person is about whether he's willing to do anything or whether he wants to escape complete a relationship with obligation.
Well, if you recognize the willingness of such groups as the Mennonites and the Brethren of Christ and the Quakers to accept alternate service, what about those whose conscience will not allow them to enter the draft?
We wouldn't have to be either one of those three. I don't want to get in trouble with the network, but you can be a Methodist. If by being a Methodist your conscience is brought to the place where you can't serve, you can serve an alternate service, but the persons that the law did not cover were the individuals who individually declaimed having, they said, I'm an atheist, but I don't happen to want to do it, and the Congress never has recognized them.
What is your feeling about those young men who have burnt their draft cards?
Oh, I think they're misguided. I have a great deal of pity for our youngsters, because for a couple of reasons. One is sometimes they're not too aware of what they're doing, and the worst time is when they're being influenced by somebody who thinks they're not liable, and therefore they can work the kids over and get them in trouble and escape anything happening to them. And for that, I probably have a great deal of sympathy for the kids and something else for those who are influencing them.
Well, a number of clergymen and a number of priests have been involved in draft burning or draft card burning. What is your feeling about them?
Well, that I think is most unfortunate. And now I don't think I'm qualified to try to defend the churches, but I certainly do, because I think that this is one way that the churches will lose their influence and their status quicker than most any other way, and they shouldn't. I feel that the advertising that churches and schools have gotten has been most unfortunate, because I don't think it's indicative of the average person, and yet the public has a tendency to group people in groups, and if they see one person in a group that's bad, they think they all are, and I think that's most unfortunate, because I don't think that the percentage of either ministers or professors are very high, but they certainly have gotten a lot of advertising.
Well, General, do you feel that most of the resistance to the draft over the past couple of years is due to the draft itself, or due more to the unwillingness to accept our involvement in Vietnam?
Well, I don't think there's any question that draft is nothing anyway but a means, and therefore they are a very convenient means, especially the director is, to have the to pour the wrath on him, because he's a little closer than all of the elements that go into the circumstances that the world is in. But I think that the circumstances are always the things that you have to worry about, and you only have the targets. The targets are not the things that they're shooting at.
This is Night Call in New York. Our conversation tonight, the draft. How does it work today, and should it be changed? Our guest tonight is Selective Service Director Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, calling in from Maryland. And we welcome our Night Call listeners tonight to join our conversation. We'll take our first call from Richmond, Indiana. Mr. Gaither is hearing Night Gaithall. I'm sorry, Mr. Gaithall is hearing Night Call of WECI-FM. And just before we go over to Mr. Gaithall, a reminder to our Night Call listeners that Night Call is your program. We welcome your comments, and we welcome your questions as well as your conversation. Our numbers in New York is 866-5010. That's in New York, 866-5010. If you're calling in from the East or the Midwest, it's area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. If you're calling from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. That's area code 212-749-3357. Our conversation again tonight, the draft. How does it work today, and should it be changed? And as promised, Mr. Gaithall. Mr. Gaithall?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I would like to ask General Hershey if he could clarify for me the policies on deferments for, first of all, teachers, and secondly, graduate students, as the regulations stand today and as they are being applied.
Well, the one is quite easy on the graduate students, because outside of those who were finishing up their doctorates or their master's and were in before before 1967, due to the Congress and due to the action of the National Security Council, there's no deferment for any graduate students. Now, when we get back to school teachers, they're deferred on the basis of shortage and need. That is, in other words, they're eligible for deferment if they can't be replaced and if they are necessary in what they're doing.
I see. Well, there has been some talk that the local draft boards are applying this in this way. They're saying if you teach in your home community and you are needed, then you will be deferred. However, if you do not teach in your home community, if, for example, you move to another community, say in another state, and even if you are needed in that state, you will not be deferred. Comment on that?
Well, human beings being what they are, I wouldn't say it does not happen, but I would say that, first of all, anyone who's teaching in another state or even another part of the state from where he lives, when he's put in 1A, if he doesn't think he should be, he ought to appeal to the appeal board in the area where he's teaching, because there they have some consideration for him. And the next thing is, if he can't get satisfaction at either his local board or his appeal board, the national headquarters is available for him to apply to, and we handle thousands of records of that kind.
I see. Then, in other words, though, are you saying that if, say, for example, I teach and I am originally registered in one place, and I have, in the course of the year since I registered and through my education, moved to another community, which is, say, 500 miles away, and I decide to stay there and teach,
right?
And I'm needed in that community, and my local draft board decides that I should be placed in 1A,
right.
Then I do have a justifiable...
You should appeal to that appeal board over where you're teaching, because for two reasons. One is they're quite impersonal, because after all, you're not one of them that they probably could know much about, but they do know whether your locality where you're teaching needs teachers.
I see.
Now, however, if that local board, if that appeal board has one vote in your favor, you have an automatic appeal to the national headquarters if they should put you in 1A. If you have no, if you get no votes at all, you have a right to go to the state director, and if he won't take an appeal for you, you can appeal to me.
I see.
So there are about four areas that you should exhaust before you give up.
Right. I see. Well, this is of some help to me, and I thank you very much for this information.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation is the draft. How does it work today, and should it be changed? Our guest calling in from Maryland is Selective Service Director, Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey. We'll return to our guest following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Louis B. Hershey after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
Large numbers of black people in this country are coming to the point where almost no action, violent or nonviolent, legal or illegal, is looked upon as being the sort of action that will help. And I think that's a dangerous point for us, where we reach the point where nothing is likely to help us. And it means, I think, almost the beginning of suicide.
Julian Bond, a black politician, is pessimistic, and a white ethics professor has faith.
I don't agree we're all upset. In spite of the many faults of the white people, I think there's a strong reservoir of compassion in a lot of white people in this country, and a strong desire to see that the black man does get his right.
These voices, plus your own voice of question or comment, are Night Call. Speak for yourself. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to Louis B. Hershey about the draft. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And returning to Night Call tonight, our conversation, the draft, how does it work today and should it be changed? And our guest calling in from the state of Maryland, Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, will take our next call from Oxford, Ohio. Mr. Getz is hearing Night Call over WMUB-FM. Mr. Getz?
Yes, Mr. Shields. If a person is in his third year of a four-year college degree and he sees that he will have to take an extra year in order to complete his requirements, what would be the proper procedure in order to extend his 2S classification from 4 years to five?
Well, I'm rather interested you're down at Oxford, because I have a granddaughter down in Miami in school. That's
your town. Yes, I know her.
And one of the problems you've got, of course, if this is a five-year course, and you can get the colleges to say so, there's no problem. Sometimes they don't say so when it does take 5 years. But it would be well if you discovered as early as you can in gone summers to try to get the thing behind you and not have to take a full year, because you will run two chances. One is that you are going to get caught not having been full-time, that is, you didn't complete the course in the time you should, and the second thing you run into is you might possibly hit 24 before you get through. But I haven't, if you can get probably to the place where you only have a quarter left, you'd run a pretty good chance probably of getting postponed for it. But if you have a whole year, if it is a five-year course, there's no problem. But if it's a four-year course, that's another matter, because you can't be full-time and be 5 years on a four-year course.
Well, it is a four-year course, and I think it's going to take an extra trimester or two. Is there any procedure that you can go through to do?
Well, the only thing you're in, you see, is that get back to the definition of full-time. I wouldn't say that you couldn't sell a local board, but if you take the regulation strictly, and I think this is not unusual because there's quite a lot of courses that they're still trying to claim in the catalog that they're for, and the load that they got on it, you just can't do it in four. But I don't know, one of the problems we've got to have perhaps is move our colleges and universities a little bit to the recognition of what constitutes full-time. Because the law says you've got to be full-time and satisfactory. And that's what creates it. Now, if you go summers, of course, you do get the whole 12 months, but there are reasons why sometimes people, for economic and other ways, can't go summers. And the ideal thing would be able to take the three summers and then certainly wouldn't have anything but the fourth summer, and that you'd be entitled to because the year is set up on a 12-month basis rather than nine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, I'm sorry.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. General Hershey, how much autonomy do the local draft boards have?
Well, within the regulations and the calls and a dozen different kinds of restrictions, they have the autonomy of either one initially to take the facts and come to a solution as to what the facts add up to. Of course, that's subject to appeal. But amount of chance they have to be independent is pretty close or restricted because the law set up the ages. It sets up, as this gentleman was just talking to me, they set up now pretty closely what a person's got to be even to be a student. And about the most that the local board can do is to have sometimes an argument with the registered and sometimes with each other over whether or not school is, in fact, running a four-year course, or whether they're running a five, but it's a little hard to decide they're running a five-year course when they advertise it as a four.
Well, in terms of interpreting the law, and in terms
well,
of
the same amount of leeway that you'd think a judge had, as you know, judges are notorious, I don't mean to criticize them, but they're human beings, and they do not see, we've got nine people over here on the hill, and four of them lots of times are completely right, and they're different than five who are completely right.
Well,
but there is in the judgment, that is in the part that has to do with judgment. For instance, if you're talking about somebody's got a dependent father, the local board's got quite a little jurisdiction on deciding whether, in fact, that father is dependent or what he isn't. Now, when you get into children, you don't have to worry about it because they're all presumed to be dependent.
All right, we'll go back to Richmond, Indiana. This time, Mr. Sector is hearing Night Call over WECI-FM. Mr. Sector?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening, sir.
General Hershey, a few days ago when you were speaking at Earlham College,
right,
you said that you were a bearer of bad news.
Yes.
And you said that your department formed little policy, that it carried
That's
out
right.
the law as stated.
Yes.
I'd like to know how much influence your department has in congressional hearings as far as helping to determine legislation.
We go over there and testify fully, but whether or not, I've had times they actually followed, probably for other reasons, what I recommended, and I've, of course, gone hundreds of times when they didn't follow. And for whatever extent that we're convincing people, and if we're convincing them that it's a solution of some sort of a problem, then I think we probably have a pretty good chance. But I'd be the last fellow that would want to go over to Congress and convince them of something that they were completely already made up their minds on. The bad news, a good example, I had to tell the graduate students that they weren't being deferred, and I didn't have anything to do with the fact that they weren't deferred, but I was the fellow that got blamed in about 90% of the press that I read for being the ones who decided that we couldn't take graduate students, and I had nothing whatever to do with it except pass on the word.
What other governmental agencies help determine or testify for Chairman
well, normally,
of the Waivers Committee?
The responsibility for getting the legislation lies with the Department of Defense because they're the people that are using the people. Now, we are secondary people on the question of whether they need a law or whether they don't. once they get a law and we get into the writing of the regulations, which the president had to put out, we are the original drafters, but we have about 40 agencies that we have to clear with, which goes, well, all through HEW and the Department of Labor and the Department of Commerce and now the Department of Transportation and on and on and on. And the Department of Justice, of course, is always about the last authority on anything that's a regulation or a law because they are the head law agency.
Well, General...
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
General
Hershey, with the new Congress coming in, do you foresee any possible sympathy on Congress's part to make any changes in the Selective Service law?
Well, my evidence is worth just what it's worth, but in the first place, this Congress, in the areas where these decisions originally come, hasn't changed practically at all. And I don't believe that the individuals, the few new ones we have, are going to be enough to make much difference. And they went over this law pretty carefully in 67. They've had a pretty long policy of only going over it about once every 4 years. And I don't want to be critical, but I haven't heard anything that I didn't hear last year. I mean, there's anything new up, and I doubt if Congress is going to get back into hearings, because they're going to have a lot of other things to decide that they're even in greater doubt about than they are the draft law.
All right, so this time we'll take a local call from New York. Mr. Brackett is here at Night Call over WLIBFM. Mr. Brackett?
Yes,
I'd like to
ask General Hershey, why is it so hard to get information out of the Selective Service system, and why is there so many young men who haven't the slightest idea what their rights are?
Well, I think
the draft law. I'm a draft counselor. I spend a good many hours every week just telling people what the law is.
Well, in the first place, I think maybe you would be quite sympathetic with the fact that if you've ever seen these boys the next week after you told them the week before, you might wonder why they didn't remember something you told them. I think that we take things for granted in this country. I don't want to dodge responsibility. Selective Service, unfortunately, at the present time, has enough money to hire enough clerks to get out the things we ought to get out. Now, when we went through the hearing a year ago, there was a great deal of noise about us not putting out the information we should. And we went back for pretty heavy budgets on trying to get some money that we could put people in local boards that are engaged in nothing else except telling people what the rules and the laws are. But we didn't get the money, and at the present time, we are getting, and in your city, a little bit of people who come in merely to take up the clerk's time so the clerk can do something else. And so I think that we've got two or three things. First of all, you've got to be very careful these days to give youngsters something to read and expect they're going to read it. And it is true that there are some things that probably are a little difficult for youngsters to understand. But I am always surprised, not only with youngsters, but I'm surprised a great deal with the legal profession that are engaged in any other part of the legal profession except ours, at their complete unfamiliarity with our laws and regulations.
Mr. Brackett, thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Our conversation tonight, the draft. How does it work today and should it be changed? Our guest calling in from Maryland is Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, the Selective Service Director. We'll return to General Hershey following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Louis B. Hershey after station identification. Next week on Night Call, a new left American revolutionary, a crime psychiatrist, a spokesman for the homosexuals of America, the black co-star of Mission Impossible, and a black television correspondent. Monday, co-founder Tom Hayden of the Students for a Democratic Society. Tuesday, Dr. James Brussell, the crime psychiatrist who helped solve the mysteries of the Mad Bomber, the Wiley murders, the Boston Strangler, and the Coppolino case. Wednesday, a mystery member of the Mattachine Society, an organization of American homosexuals. Thursday, actor Greg Morris of Mission Impossible. And Friday, Bob Teague of NBC News. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to Louis B. Hershey about the draft. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who join us nightly for the second half hour tonight. Our conversation, The Draft, How Does It Work Today and Should It Be Changed? And our guest, Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, the Selective Service Director, calling in from Maryland. We'll begin this half hour by going out to Kansas City, Missouri. Mr. Jones is hearing Night Call over KPRS-FM. Mr. Jones?
Yes, I would like to ask General Hershey two questions. The first one is dealing with the age limit, dealing with the draft. Is there a set policy? I'm a young man in his 20s as to when he can or cannot be drafted if he has had a college deferment.
In the first place, as to the age, you register at 18, you become liable at 18 and a half. You cannot be inducted until you're 19 unless all of the other people above 19 are gone. If you are deferred for college, as long as you're full-time and satisfactory, which means that you're finishing your courses on schedule, then you have until you're 24. Now, the upper age, the primary upper age is 26, and we're not at the present time taking anybody above 26 except the individuals who may be delinquents. And they are liable, however, until they're 35. But as a matter of practical things, 19 to 25 are the two age groups. Now, maybe I missed some of your other questions.
Well, on the age part, yes. I'm age 26.
Yes.
And my present classification is 1A.
Yes, and but they don't take you.
They will or will not?
No, not unless something happens. Well, quite different than has happened for the last 3 or 4 years, and with the surplus that we have at the present time with somewhere approaching 2 million births among the males 18, 19 years ago, the shortage is not very apparent. We have had some individuals above 26 that who have been reclassified when we got into some of this delinquency business, but the individuals who is 1A, he's coasting along, but we haven't taken any above 26 since back Korean War time.
Okay, and the second question I had is what is your opinions towards a lottery system for the draft?
The lottery system is a method of deciding the priority, and when you have a surplus, it's one means. Whether it's any better than a judgment means or not, there remains to be seen. One of the problems we have now is it's prohibited by law. Mm-hmm. And until the law is changed, there isn't any chance of having it. I have no great quarrel against the lottery at the time we have surplus. It's not a good thing when we have shortage.
Could this be done by executive order? Would it have to be enacted by Congress?
We have to go to Congress because the Congress, we could have done it up till the last, a year ago, the last summer, by executive order any time that they wanted to change it. But we did have a committee that recommended, the Burke Marshall Committee, and the Congress, instead of approving it, passed a law prohibiting it.
Uh-huh.
And that's where we are at the present time. I don't know about how badly, how hard Congress would fight to hang on to it or not. There are some members of Congress that are very much opposed to the lottery, and of course a lot of them are for it.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. Our conversation tonight, The Draft, How Does It Work Today and Should It Be Changed? And our guest calling in from Maryland is Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, the Selective Service Director. This time out to Boston, Mr. Kelly is hearing Night Call over WBUR-FM. Mr. Kelly?
Hello.
Good morning, sir.
I have a couple of questions to ask General Hershey. I wonder, the first one is just procedural. I understood you to say a few minutes ago, General, that a person's academic year lasts 12 months from the moment the term begins.
That's right.
Does this apply after the person has graduated?
No. Well, after a person has graduated, you see, then if you start into graduate school, then you're in another deal, and the reason you have a year is you were given a year to go to school. When you're doing something else, of course, you can't be deferred as a student when you're not a student.
Let me clarify this a bit. What I specifically mean is, does a person who's entering his senior year, is he deferred from 1 year after the beginning of his senior year, or is he deferred only until his graduation?
Until his graduation, because the graduation marks the end of his student body, student history, and the only thing he could take from then on would be postgraduate work, and that's where we run into the prohibition against any of the individuals taking postgraduate work except doctors and dentists.
All right. Well, I see. Very fine. The other question I had was about the channeling function of selective service. Now, I've noticed that you do generally have a paragraph or two on channeling in the annual report of the director.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, the theory of channeling is that large numbers of people are induced to enter certain fields of endeavor in civilian life as deferments in order to escape the draft.
Well, of course, that might be the process. Maybe that's the way the individual look at it, but the government doesn't look at it that way. The government says we got to have doctors. Okay, we defer people to become doctors. We got to have engineers. We defer people to become engineers. And now this goes through the scientific area, and of course I happen to be an old liberal arts student, and therefore so many people have no appreciation how important we are. But it is true that the government uses deferment to produce the kind of people it has to have to survive as a nation. Now, it is true that the youngster that takes an engineering course may very well prefer to be an engineer than to be out in the armed forces. But of course, as you get to be an engineer, if we need engineers in the armed forces, just like we need doctors now, then we induct them especially. So the purpose, there's no excuse for any sort of channeling except to fill a need that the government has in order to survive.
Well, if I may, I'd just like to clarify my question. Looking at it from the government's point of view, channeling really won't work unless large numbers of people are willing to be channeled.
That's right.
There has to be some sort of some kind of repugnance for the army in order for these people to avoid it in this way.
I wouldn't. I've been there probably 3 to 4 times at your age, but I wouldn't agree to that. I would say this though, that it is true that if people will not go into a profession by getting a deferment, then obviously the government's got to find some other way to provide the individuals for that particular thing. Now, some other countries, when they want a fellow to be an engineer, they just tell him. But we have never gone on, we've always gone on to the system of trying to provide an attractiveness to get him in the place we want, and it's much more difficult to handle your manpower by that sort of thing than it is by order. But on the other hand, I think it's much better, because you can't have a democratic state very much if the individual has no choice whatsoever. We in a democracy have fewer choices than we think we have.
Very few, I'd say.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, our conversation, The Draft, How Does It Work Today and Should It Be Changed? And this time out to Loveland, Colorado, Mr. Gothwaite is hearing Night Call over KLOV-FM. Mr. Gothwaite?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening, sir.
First, let me say that for a general and a man that is portrayed in the press so often as quite a baron and ogre, he sounds quite reasonable, if I might say so.
You live out in the same town as Bill Reed.
General Bill Reed.
All right.
I guess he was colonel.
He's general.
Pardon me?
Bill was retired as a general.
Right, okay. Let me ask one question first of all. The figures available and how many of the administrators and let us say those employed or serving on the selective service system are past military personnel?
I'd say that a pretty high percentage. I haven't got it at hand, but I would... That doesn't apply to our clerks, because most of the clerks are girls and they haven't served. But of the individuals who are on, there's quite a percentage of them are veterans. There's no question about that, because, sometimes a veteran is a little more likely to feel that he still has an obligation, especially if he's put in quite a little into the government. I can't give you the numbers, but I think it's pretty high, and I'm trying to think what I know about Colorado, but I think you'll know it. There's a lot of veterans that are on the boards out there.
Right, and this is being attacked from many quarters, the people making the decisions, the actual decision of who goes and who doesn't go, so to speak. The majority of these people, I think we'll find if we check the figures, are, as you say, veterans. Now, what's your comment on...
My comment would be that if we're afraid to trust the people that have offered their lives for this country to decide who's going to keep on offering it, then we're getting to the place where we want the people who've always, either for one reason or other, didn't accept an obligation, deciding. And unfortunately... one of the things the board gets up with, and I'm sure you know this as well as I do, they have to send somebody, and when they defer one man, they just send another man ahead of his time.
But, General, aren't the veterans less likely to be sympathetic towards the man who may not want to go?
Well, I think so. But on the other hand, I don't believe anybody in Congress is very sympathetic about the man that doesn't want to go, because if a man doesn't want to go, somebody else has to go. He doesn't want to go either.
Right, but it's all how the public views it. For instance, a large number of college students in this area, and in fact in many areas, as evidenced by reports in the press,
right,
feel that there cannot be any real justice when the decision is being made by someone perhaps 50 years their senior, in some cases, at least their senior, and an individual that has had past military service. They feel that there's
We're missing a point here about, I think we are trying to decide how we can best get people who want to go. It doesn't happen to be the Congress never has set up any standards of letting people off merely because they didn't want to go. And so therefore, I wouldn't think that would be a very good argument to attack something because somebody was not being sympathetic to people who didn't want to go. Now, I don't think there's any question that a veteran is just about as sympathetic to a fellow that's got an invalid father, especially if his father happened to be a veteran. I'd rather have my case decided by a veteran as a dependency business than somebody that never had gone off and left his father.
Well, but you're giving specific examples. I'm talking about the overall picture.
Well, the practice
in the judicial system of this country that... judicial questions, we attempt to get people that are as far removed from the question, from either side of the question, to make decisions on that question.
Well, now, in the first place... you're introducing something that the Congress never has given to the judiciary any power on classification. After all, the Congress made every one of these boys a 1A, and the local boards are the only ones that can make them anything but 1As. In other words, the obligation came from Congress. It's a little different because we're still a descendant of the old militia system where every able-bodied man was supposed to be come out when the drum beats of the bugle blew. And so the local boards, in the first place, are the ones that let somebody off from an obligation because the Congress gave it to them.
But the obligation was there, but the decision to make the individual 1A, let us say in the case of a student that has had a 2S...
Well, now, how did he get his 2S?
Pardon me?
Where did he get his 2S? Got it from a local board. He couldn't get it anywhere else. Congress never gave anybody a 2S.
I don't think Congress ever gave anybody a 1A.
No, but on the other hand, the Congress did make every one of them liable.
Ms. Guthrie?
The regulations say that everybody shall be 1A until, by the action of a local board, they get some other classification.
I see. Okay.
Ms. Guthrie, thank you for calling, sir.
Right.
Thank you. General Hershey, yes. Mr. Gothwaite mentioned that he found you a little bit different than what the press had shown you. I was wondering, what is your feeling about the press that you've received?
About the press?
The press, yes.
Well, in the first place, the press and your business and the television's all got to go on the unusual, and they've got to have something that's energetic or at least violent before they can get the public to look at it. And I'm not going to get any headlines by eating my breakfast food quietly and all that sort of thing. And it's
It's just one of the prices you have to pay for being a target.
How long have you been Selective Service Director, sir?
28 years.
28 years?
Since 1941, and I was acting for about a year before that.
Have you enjoyed this work?
Well, I enjoy some of the finest people. Now, I've got around 50,000 people that have worked for the Selective Service many long years and taken all this noise, and they got no pay for it. And I'll put them up against anybody's teaching, school, doctoring, or doing anything else for nothing.
Our conversation tonight, the draft, how does it work today, and should it be changed? We'll return to our guest tonight, General Hershey, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Louis B. Hershey after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, Melvin Van Peebles is a writer of poetry, of novels, of essays. He is soon to be a ballet impresario and produce a television series. His latest book is A Bear for the FBI. Melvin Van Peebles is first and foremost a filmmaker, the first black man to direct a feature motion picture, The Story of a Three-Day Pass. Van Peebles says his bag is not just the black one, it's the whole human one. He's much more concerned with being a human being than being a black human being. But the things this black man had to overcome to make his first movie are worth an entire edition of Night Call. So, The Problems of a Black Filmmaker with Melvin Van Peebles, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to Louis B. Hershey about the draft. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, the Selective Service Director who's calling in from Maryland tonight as we continue our conversation on the draft. How does it work today and should it be changed? To Atlanta, Georgia we go, and Mr. Schmidt is hearing Night Call over WAOK. Mr. Schmidt?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Your question?
I have two questions.
All right.
And the first one is, I'm a student, and my... we apply for a 2S every year, and my 2S ran out the 1st of October, but I haven't heard from my local draft board yet, and I was just wondering, what in the world could be holding him up. And the second question is, Mr. Hershey, if he believes that if the United States were to change the imperialistic nature of its foreign policy, if we would, if it would be absolutely necessary to have a draft.
Mr. Schmidt, General Hershey, just before you answer, Mr. Schmidt, I'm going to ask you to hang up because we're having a disturbance on your line, and General Hershey will answer you, so listen to your radio.
I'll hang up or he hangs up.
No, Mr. Schmidt, let me... Mr. Schmidt?
Yes, sir.
Please hang up because we're having a disturbance on your line, and General Hershey will answer you over the air. Okay? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
General?
Now you want me to go ahead and answer?
Yes, sir.
Well, in the first place, the problem of whether we're an imperialistic nation and whether we're that sort of thing... my opinion on that, I don't consider worth anything. I'm interested in the United States and its survival. I happen to believe at the present time, in order to get the number of people to survive under our present circumstances, we have to have compulsion. Now, as to his situation on his student, he's only been a couple of months since he started into school. I think probably he'd heard something from the local board unfavorable if they hadn't have... more or less made up their mind to give him his 2S, but there has been a quite a heavy load this year, and there has been some change in the regulations, and if I were in his place, the things I'd worry about was to be sure that I was full-time and satisfactory as a student, and that my school so notified this local board so that they would have then the basis of the law for classifying him, and of course, if he isn't, if he's under 24, he's all right. If he's over 24, he's going to be in trouble anyway, because that's the upper age.
General, what is the address in Washington where you can be contacted, or the headquarters of Selective Service?
The headquarters is at 1724 F Street, Northwest. But on the other hand, if you put National Selective Service Headquarters, I think they'd forget it.
They'll forget it?
No, we would get it.
Oh, you would get it. National Selective Service.
1724 F Street, Northwest.
Right. All right, sir.
And there's nothing else in that building except us.
I see. All right, this time we'll go out to Bellevue, Washington. Mr. John Rogers is hearing Night Call over KUOW. Mr. Rogers?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Your question?
I'd like to ask General Hershey if he could or would state an opinion of President-elect Nixon's idea of a professional army.
Well, I don't think my opinion would be much good. As I remember, I think you're referring to the fact that I think Mr. Nixon has said that he is going to attempt to get away from the draft as soon as the Vietnamese war is over. And, of course, I think that presumes that we have no more trouble of this kind, and I don't know just for sure what it presumes on the part of, say, of the Middle East and Korea at the present time. But I think that that's quite in line with what the Congress is. I don't believe Congress would have a draft if they didn't have to have it in order to maintain the number of people they had. And I'm presuming, because the Mr. Nixon has also said that he's going to strengthen our armed forces, that he is going to still provide means for getting them in. So I don't believe I would have any. The only thing I would doubt, on the basis of the last 20 years of history, that we're going to have a quiet spell so that when we get Vietnamese business over, we aren't tied up in something else.
Yes, I see.
I have a son out at Bremerton.
I beg your pardon?
I have a son up at Bremerton.
You have?
Yeah.
Thank you. Another question, sir?
My thought on the thing would be the possibility of it creating a political faction over a period of years if you did have a professional army. I don't know if this would be any more true in the future as it would be today, but I'm just curious as to what your opinion
is. Well, I happen to not be one of these. I've been in the professional army since 1920, but I don't happen to be one who wants my grandchildren defended solely by a professional army, because in the first place, you can never have enough, and they ought to have to resort to the reserves, the guard, or some other part of our manpower pool. And therefore, it's just a question of whether you have the draft in being or whether you have it in reserve to use when you have to have it.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for calling, sir. General Hershey, since we were talking about the president-elect early in the campaign, as we recall, you were quoted as stating that you could work with Governor Wallace if he were elected.
Yes, I was quoted a little more than that. I was quoted as saying that I favored Governor Wallace. And that
you favored him.
That I took some exception to. Now, I had a youngster that was taking this down, and I'm accrediting him with misunderstanding of a rather complicated thing. On the other hand, if I wanted to, I suppose, be suspicious, I might think somebody thought this is a way to make news. I was asked what I thought of the candidates, and this is before we had any conventions, and I mentioned the fact that I had known Governor Rockefeller for about 10 years as governor of what amounts to two states, because we run the city of New York separately. I had known Governor Stassen when he was in Minnesota. I had known two of the candidates as vice presidents of the United States. And there was one senator who had already expressed his opinion of me, and so I said there was no use of talking about that. And then I said you might be surprised that I had worked with Governor Wallace, because we had finished not too long before that getting some Negroes on the local boards in Alabama, and that requires some work. But that didn't mean that I was supporting any of these individuals, because I've been out of politics for about 50 years, and I do not openly support anybody. I vote, but that's my business.
All right, sir, we'll go out to Jacksonville, Florida. Mr. Dukes is hearing Night Call over WRHC. Mr. Dukes?
Yes, I would like to know, ask General Hershey, how difficult would it be for the government to work out some type of voluntary military system and eliminate the draft, because because I think it's very antiquated and it creates a lot of problems. You know, as you can see, it's got the youth in this country today all split up, you know, against this so-called establishment. And I would like to know if it's possible for them to work out some type of...
Well, let me answer on the volunteer system, because you've loaded your question pretty well, and I don't happen to go along with some of your load. In the first place, I heard the commander of the 1st Division say within the last 10 days that he never saw as widespread and as representative bunch of young Americans as in the Big Red One down in Vietnam. I didn't say so. That's what he said, and I think we are represented. But back to the volunteer business. The problem is to, when you have 3 million plus, as we have now, to get enough people to volunteer. And most of the time, we have tried to solve it by money. And most of the time, we somehow or other have never been able to get the salaries high enough without probably completely ruining the economic part of the country in order to get these individuals. Now, I don't say that it can't be done. I have been involved for about 58 years in the armed forces, and I have never seen the time that they could get enough people when they needed many. Now, when we had 125,000 in the armed forces, we did get them by volunteering, but I will say that the standards were nowhere near as high as they are now, because you just had to lower your standards in order to get the people. But that doesn't mean that somebody can't figure a way, either by prestige or something else, that you can get them. But I have not, in my experience, they haven't been able to.
Well, I think that if the salary was raised a little, say, comparable to something like a fireman or policeman, I mean, even though these young men are risking their lives more, even more, I think, you know.
Yes, I agree with that. Of course, one of the problems you got is that you pay a policeman, you pay him, and he has to board and house himself, and of course, sometimes he gets some uniforms allowance, and sometimes he does not. And the amount of money that you pay a soldier, sailor, marine, coast guard, or airman is only a relatively small part of what he's costing the government, because they do of course support him completely. And I agree with you perfectly. In theory, there hadn't ought to be any problem, but I have seen the pay go from $15 a month to near 100, and it's more difficult recruiting. Right now, it depends pretty much on our calls. At the present time, I examine 5 people for every man we induct, because 2 get rejected and 2 enlist. And what caused them to enlist is to find out that they'd already been accepted and that we were going to induct them next if they didn't.
Mr. Dukes, thank you for calling,
yes,
sir.
I was going to tell him I was a veteran myself. I'm a veteran myself.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
General Hershey, we have just a few seconds remaining, and I was wondering if you see any possibility of any of the Selective Service laws being changed over the next few years.
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any question. I doubt if you'll get, unless there's something rather dynamic comes, I doubt if we'll have too much legislation for 2 or 3 years because of the fact that they've already gone over it pretty thoroughly. But on the other hand, I'd be the last one to say that we shouldn't always be striving to find something we can change. But one of the things that I think...
General Hershey, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, The Problems of a Black Filmmaker with Melvin Van Peebles, the first black man to direct a feature motion picture. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.